Hello, everyone, and happy Wednesday before Christmas. So it's good to see y'all. And this week I will be starting again, sharing from the spiritual teaching of Ramana Maharshi. But first, I'm going to play a song, and this song is a little different than the songs I typically play. Gosh, maybe I should change my mind and play a Christmas song, though. I don't have much opportunity to do that either. Well, no, I'll go ahead and play this song. This song is a bluegrass song. In my younger years, when I was around 20, I used to adore bluegrass. And in fact, I spent most weekends, you know, at least one or two a month, and many weekends, going to bluegrass festivals and camping. And there was one band that I especially loved called the Johnson Mountain Boys. And in fact, they're a Grammy award-winning bluegrass band, although the bluegrass category doesn't make it to television. Is Grammy the right word for the music? Whatever the music people get. This song by the Johnson Mountain Boys, you know, it's kind of, you know, if heard with the wrong mind, it's kind of a judgmental song. It's judging people, it sounds like, for, you know, claiming to be religious, but still carrying on in ways that, you know, aren't perceived as religious by the Protestant mind. But I think I love this song for two reasons. One, it is the Johnson Mountain Boys, and I do still love them. But two, I take it in a non-specific way. I take the song in a very general way, just to remind me to live my spirituality, to be from the right mind instead of from the wrong mind. So if you ignore the specific accusations in the song and just listen to that general reminder, you know, to really walk my talk, plus remember that I love the Johnson Mountain Boys, then maybe you'll enjoy this song too. So here we go. The Johnson Mountain Boys, the song is called Do You Call That Religion?
Preacher in his church house, all reared back in his chair. And when you tell him about his duty, he'll say that he don't care.
Do you call that religion?
Oh, no.
Do you call that religion?
No, child, no.
Do you call that religion?
Oh, no.
Ain't that a shame?
Well, you claim that you've been converted. Well, why don't you stop telling lies? Quit drinking your beer and your whiskey and live a more different life.
Do you call that religion?
Oh, no.
Do you call that religion?
No, child, no.
Do you call that religion?
Oh, no.
I declare, ain't that a shame?
Last Sunday when the preacher was preaching, Lord, you all began to shout. But when he asked for a little collection, you had your mouth poked out.
Do you call that religion?
Oh, no.
Do you call that religion?
No, child, no.
Do you call that religion?
Oh, no.
I declare, ain't that a
shame. I declare, ain't that a shame? I declare, ain't that a shame?
Oh.
All right, the Johnson Mountain Boys. So thanks for humoring me and letting me play a little bit of bluegrass today. So now we are ready for the spiritual teaching of Ramana Maharshi. And I am on page, let's see where we left off. Yeah, the last thing we read was on page 21, and it was question number 4, and I'll just kind of quickly go over this question number 4, because to be honest, this question number 4 has not left my contemplation since I read it 3 weeks ago. It's just really, really stuck with me. But it may have left some of y'all's contemplation, so let me go ahead and just review it again and then we'll move on. The question was, is the state of being still a state involving effort or effortless? So is the state of being still a state involving effort or effortless? And Ramana Maharshi says, it is not an effortless state of indolence or laziness. And again, the reason for that is because we could say that the default in this world is the ego. And so if we are spiritually lazy, the ego just remains in control, right? So it is not an effortless state of indolence. All mundane activities, which are ordinarily called effort, are performed with the aid of a portion of the mind and with frequent breaks. So you might think about your work, whatever your work is. If you have a job, you might think about your job. If you do housework, cleaning house, or yard work, pulling weeds, mowing lawns, anything at all, any kind of work that you do, you know, we typically call work effort. And he's saying that any type of effort, anything that we call effort, usually it only requires a portion of the mind. Like when you're, you know, when you're mowing your lawn or cleaning your house or even doing your job, it's not taking your full concentration 100% of the time. You know, that effort only requires a portion of the mind. And not only that, he says, but it's performed with frequent breaks. You know, none of us work at cleaning our house or maintaining our lawn or doing our job 24/7, right? There are breaks. In fact, we even have a term called coffee break, right? So again, all mundane activities, which are ordinarily called effort, are performed with the aid of a portion of the mind and with frequent breaks. But the act of communion with the self, or remaining still inwardly, is intense activity, which is performed with the entire mind and without a break. So again, the question was, is being still, does that involve effort or effortless? And he said, well, it's definitely not laziness. And it is not what you call effort, because what you call effort only uses a portion of the mind and you get breaks. He says, this is intense activity. This is more than effort, because it requires the entire mind and you take no break. So Ramana Maharshi's answer to that question, which again, as I said, has stayed in my contemplation since I read this question here 3 weeks ago. And so now I'm going to move on to question number 5. What is the nature of Maya? Or we could say, what is the nature of illusion? Maya is that which makes us regard as non-existent the self, the reality, which is always and everywhere present and all-pervasive and self-luminous. And as existent, the individual soul, the world, and God, which have been conclusively proved to be non-existent at all times and places. So this is one long, long sentence. And as a result, especially if you aren't looking at the page and seeing where the commas are, you may get lost. So what I'm going to do is break this into two sentences. So again, the question is, what is the nature of Maya? Maya is that which makes us regard as non-existent the self, the reality, which is always and everywhere present and all-pervasive and self-luminous. Maya is also that which makes us regard as existent the individual soul, the world, and God, which have been conclusively proved to be non-existent at all times and places. Reminds me of a quote that I also have been contemplating in the last couple of weeks, and I think I might even have put it in one of the tips, so you may have seen it, although I'm not 100% certain about that. But in the quote, it basically says that everything the enlightened man considers existent, the ignorant man is unaware of. And likewise, everything the ignorant man considers existent, the enlightened man is unaware of. And really, Ramana Maharshi is giving the exact same answer here. And Maya is that which causes this confusion. So Maya is that which covers up the truth, which the enlightened man sees and knows. And Maya is also that which presents the untruth, which only the ignorant man sees and knows. And most people on the spiritual path would not have an argument with the first part of this sentence. Maya is that which makes us regard as non-existent, the self, the reality, right? Most people on the spiritual path would not argue with that. Illusion is the veil that hides reality. But some people on the spiritual path might argue with the second part of this teaching, which is that Maya is what makes the individual soul seem real. It's what makes the world seem real. And it's what makes God seem real, even though none of these are real. So, the individual soul is more than the apparent person. Like right now, I appear to be Regina Dawn Akers. But when Regina dies completely. Everything that makes up this apparent person, personality dies. And the individual soul continues within the illusion. And typically the experience that we refer to with the individual soul is reincarnation. It then reincarnates as another apparent person. And I think there are probably more possibilities for the individual soul than just reincarnating on earth as another apparent person. But that's the one that we usually refer to, so I'll just stick with that one. But again, the soul then is more than Regina, because Regina dies and, Eric is born. I mean, let's pick somebody, but, you know, but it's the same soul. And some people think of that soul, which survives the person, survives the personality, survives the body, as real. And Ramana Maharshi is saying it is not real. It is Maya. It is illusion. There is no reality at all to an individual soul. And if you think of the concept of individual soul, which again many people are attached to, you can see that there are many, you know, billions of individual souls. And if there are billions, or, you know, if we take in all the possible worlds and times, maybe trillions, right? If there are billions or trillions of souls, that concept is still within the illusion of separation. It is not the reality that transcends separation. It is not the non-dual reality. So the individual soul is a part of Maya. It's a part of illusion. The next thing that he says is a part of Maya or is a part of illusion is the world. And again, this is a debate that I've been aware of ever since I first became aware of other course students. When I first started studying the course, I wasn't aware of other course students. But when I became aware of other course students and their conversations, the debate of whether the world is real or not real, whether the world disappears when you wake up or does not disappear when you wake up, is something that is always being debated. And it's interesting because the course says very clearly, and again, I can't say that I know this from my own personal experience, so I'm just going to share what the course teaches and what other masters teach, and then we can just take it under contemplation. But the course says in workbook lesson 132, let me see if I can find it. Right, it's the central theme sentence that I don't have my highlights here. I'm sure I'd have it highlighted. I would love to read the exact. Oh, here it is. There is no world. This is paragraph 5 to lesson 132. There is no world apart from what you wish, and herein lies your ultimate release. Change but your mind on what you want to see, and all the world must change accordingly. Ideas leave not their source. Now, that's not the part I'm looking for. It says this central theme is often stated in the text, but that's not the one I'm looking for. There's another sentence in here that talks about how the world does not exist, and that this is the central theme that the course teaches, and that each man must go as far as he can in accepting this theme in this lifetime, and then possibly die and come back to another lifetime and go even further to accepting this truth. But I cannot find that. Let's see. I cannot find that quickly. I don't know if anybody else can. Just too many words to look through. So I'll just put that aside. But I know that is taught in lesson 132. I'm pretty sure I'm correct about that, that lesson 132 is where that teaching comes from. So I'll put that aside. And let me pick up another book. Let's see. This book is easier to look at because there aren't quite so many words. This book quotes many different spiritual teachers on this topic. Okay, so we're looking at Ramana Maharshi right now, so I won't quote him. So this is Annamalai Swami. The eye of the self, consciousness, alone constitutes true seeing. That eye never perceives anything at all. If it be said that the eye perceives anything whatsoever, then that eye too, like the thing it perceives, is a mental creation. It is not the true I. In the heart, the self that exists as the I of grace, none of the worlds truly exist. The self, revealed as our true nature within the heart through the power of self-inquiry, is none other than the peerless reality of the Supreme, which alone remains after this worldly illusion has faded into nothingness. Okay, so now we'll look at Nisargadatta Maharaj. He who knows the state in which there is neither the world nor the thought of it, he is the supreme teacher. Without imagination, there is no world. There is no body, nor a world to contain it. There is only a mental condition, a dreamlike state, easy to dispel by questioning its reality. Let's see, what other teachers have we got here? This is the Yoga Vasistha. Cosmic consciousness alone exists now and forever. In it are no worlds, no created beings. There is no universe, no distance, no barriers. When there is notion of creation, the creation seems to be. And when through self-effort there is understanding of non-creation, there is no world. Let's see, have we got any other teachers here? There's lots and lots of Yoga Vasistha. Okay, here is Adi Sankara. Where has the world gone? Who has removed it? Or where has it disappeared to? I saw it only just now. And now it is not there. I see not, nor hear, nor know aught of this world, for I bear the mark of the self, whose form is being and bliss. The world no longer is, whether past, present, or to come. After awakening to the supreme reality in the real self, the eternal, from all wavering free. I have another book, which again, it'd be like the course. I'd have to look through too many words to find exactly what I'm looking for. But I'm reading a book by Bernadette Roberts called What is the Self? And in it, she describes the final awakening. And she says the exact same thing that all of these teachers say. That in the final awakening, there is no world, but there is something that she calls eternal form, which she says is indescribable and cannot be described. But she says the same thing that the quote I mentioned earlier about how what the enlightened man sees is non-existent to the ignorant man, and what the ignorant man sees is non-existent to the enlightened man. Bernadette Roberts says that the world that consciousness sees or that mind sees does not exist once the final awakening has occurred, but that the eternal form that the final awakening is aware of, that is something that, you know, when you're a human in a world, you're completely unaware of. So, you know, it's just repeated. And I'm sure if I was wise enough to have more sources at my fingertips, but I've always been one who really sticks with a small number of sources. I haven't read thousands of books like some people have. But I'm certain that if I had read thousands of books, I could point to more and more sources from different religions, different times, but people who have awakened to what is called the final reality or the supreme, all sharing the same message. So it's an interesting thing because, you know, what do you do with the idea that the world itself is an illusion, and that the only reason that you can perceive the world is because you are unaware of truth, because you are ignorant. I can only tell you what I do with that. I just take that as an indication that it's useful for me to continue to practice, that it's useful for me to continue to engage in meditation and contemplation and, you know, not speaking from my ego, not acting from my ego. If some type of strong emotion comes up, resting, accepting, and trusting rather than believing and acting from. To me, it is just important that I just continue in the posture of student. As long as I see a world, if the masters that I trust are speaking the truth, and I do trust them, then as long as I see the world, I am still a student. I am not yet the teacher. In spite of the fact that I appear to teach, I am still the student. So that's what I do with that message. Just makes it simple. And then I don't accidentally become one of, I think, the many deluded people who perceive themselves as awake when only the ego has deluded them into thinking that so that they would stop being the student. Now, the other thing that Ramana Maharshi says does not exist, that Maya makes it appear that it exists, but it does not exist, is God. And that's a really, really interesting one. It's funny because I am reading this book by Bernadette Roberts, which, by the way, I don't want to, even though I talk a lot about how I'm reading it now and I am sharing from it in different forms, I don't necessarily recommend the book because her way of looking at things is so incredibly different because she looks at it from a Catholic frame of reference that I think it could confuse some people. You know, her language is so different. And so, and the book itself is almost like reading a textbook. It's very thick, very, you know, it's like, you know, the first time you read the course, maybe how hard the course was to comprehend. Her book, What is the Self, is just as difficult. But it's interesting because she was a very devout Catholic seeker. And so you can imagine that God and Christ, you know, very important aspects of what she sought. And in fact, for a time, she even was a nun, a sequestered nun, a Carmelite nun. Later, she ended up leaving that, and she ended up somehow, I don't know the details of her life, she doesn't give enough details, but I know she ended up with four children somewhere along the way. She never mentions I got married, but I think maybe she did. I don't know how this happened, that she had four children. She went in one book from being a Carmelite nun to another book being a mother with four kids, so something happened in between the two. But as she goes through her awakening process, what she really writes a lot about is the discovery, the recognition that there's no God. That had just been a human concept, a human projection. And if you really consider, even for a moment, the idea of the word non-dual. Non-dual means not two. Then what you can see is there can't be even a me and my God. or there can't be even a father and a son. Because within those types of ideas, a me and my God, a father and a son, there's duality. And so when awakening to this final reality, we've awakened beyond all such concepts into only that which is the final reality. So again, this answer, what is the nature of Maya, or what is the nature of illusion? Maya is that which makes us regard as non-existent the self, the reality, which is always and everywhere present and all-pervasive and self-luminous. Maya is that which makes us regard as existent the individual soul, the world, and God, which have conclusively proved to be non-existent at all times and places. So again, what the enlightened man is aware of, the ignorant is unaware of. What the enlightened man knows to be existent, the ignorant man does not know. And what the ignorant man knows to be existent or perceives to be existent, the enlightened man does not know. Question number 6. As the self shines fully of its own accord, why is it not generally recognized like the other objects of the world by all persons? Now, that's a pretty good question. As the self shines fully of its own accord, why is it not generally recognized like the other objects of the world, by all persons? Like, you can get all persons to agree, to point up there and agree, that's the sun. Or you can get all persons to agree, point and agree, that's the moon, or those are stars. But how come you can't get all persons to agree on this self if it shines fully of its own accord? Here's Ramana Maharshi's answer. Wherever particular objects are known, it is the self which has known itself in the form of those objects. For what is known as knowledge or awareness is only the potency of the self. The self is the only sentient object. There is nothing apart from the self. If there are such objects, they are all insentient and therefore cannot either know themselves or mutually know one another. It is because the self does not know its true nature in this manner that it seems to be immersed and struggling in the ocean of birth, in the form of the individual soul. First of all, again, maybe you guys will end up reading this book as much as I say don't. Actually, I'm reading two books by Bernadette Roberts. One is easier to read. The one that's easier to read, it's more like a story. It's called The Experience of No Self. And the one that's more difficult to read, it's more like a textbook, is called What is the Self? But I find that the two books go together, and that, you know, if you read one without the other, you're missing a part of what she's presenting. and in the simpler book, in the story, as she's really describing the story of her awakening and the different phases she went through. She goes through this one phase that she says would be so horrible to someone still experiencing through the ego that they would not survive. That she's really grateful that those who still experience through an ego don't get to this stage, that the ego goes first, because otherwise, she says that, you know, we could not survive. She says it's the stage of seeing that there's no life in everything that we thought had life. You know, like as I sit here as a human, it appears I have life. You know, there's life in me. And Jamie just walked into the room. There appears to be life in Jamie. And she went through a stage of seeing that there's no life in anything in that way. She says it would be a dreadful experience if there was an ego. You might look at it this way. It might be like if somehow you lived in a coloring book. You were a character in a coloring book. And you thought everything else in the coloring book was alive. And then one day you begin to wake up from the illusion. And one of the first things you notice when you begin to wake up from the illusion is you look around at the trees and the flowers and the other people on the coloring book page, and you realize they're lifeless. They never were alive. That's really the experience that she's describing. Now, again, that was a stage that was passed through where she then awoke to what true life is, you know, which was a joyous awakening. But first there was going through this, you know, you could almost call it a stage of letting go of thinking that life is in things. There's a life in a bird, a life in a flower, a life in a dog, and seeing that that's not true. And so this passing through, she called that actually the passageway, this passing through the passageway, and then you come out the other side and you know what life is. That is what she said, that if there was an ego, it would just be, you know, it's like a walking graveyard. I mean, again, imagine yourself as a character in a coloring book, and you thought everything in that coloring book is real, and then you start to wake up from that dream that you're a character in a coloring book, and part of the first thing you do is you look around and you see just these two-dimensional, flat, lifeless images. So what Ramana Maharshi is saying in this particular answer is that the things that we think have life in them are not what life is. Again, that's how the ignorant sees. That's how the unenlightened sees. That the only thing that actually has life is the self. But what happens is the self, confused about its true nature, projects its life onto these lifeless images, and they appear to live. And so because the self is confused about its own true nature and it's projecting its life onto these other images and thinking those things live, it's not noticing the most obvious fact in the world, which is itself as the life of everything and independent of everything. I'm going to grab another book and read kind of a simpler way of saying this. This is NTI Colossians NTI Colossians says, you are the flow that is the first and the last, the beginning and the end, the creator of all things within time. You are the heavens and the earth, the bees and the sunshine. You are the process that made all things and is all things so that they live through the process that created them. You are the flow of life and separate from nothing that is life. For that which flows through them is the process that you are. You are beyond concepts and differences and form, and within the life force that is all things. You are the life force that is in all things. Without you, they have no life. Imagine ourselves as electricity. And let's imagine ourselves as electricity in this magnificent mansion. There's this huge chandelier that lights up. These beautiful lamps that light up. There's a closet light that lights. You know, maybe even it's Christmas time and we notice out the window the Christmas lights that light. And imagine that we have the confusion that the chandelier is alive with light. The chandelier is alive. The lamps in the room are alive. That bulb in the closet is alive. Those Christmas lights outside are alive. When actually the chandelier has no life, that is me, the electricity that's causing it to appear to have life. The lamps have no life or no light of their own. That is me, the electricity. It's me that causes the lamps to appear to have life or light. This is the type of confusion that Ramana Maharshi is speaking of. And you can see that this is the idea of separation. Right? I think the chandelier has individual light. I think each lamp has individual light. Each light bulb has individual light. When actually it's all me, light, electricity. It's all me. And so I miss seeing me, the electricity. I miss the obviousness of the electricity that's causing all of the light by focusing on the lights and thinking they have their own power. This is the confusion that we have. We don't see ourselves as life. We see ourselves as bodies that have life within us. We have life within us, and that body has a life within it, and that body has a life within it. That's like the electricity saying that lamp has a light in it, and that lamp has a light in it. But we're confused to our nature as the only actual life. So again, the question is, as the self shines fully of its own accord, why is it not generally recognized like the other objects of the world by all persons? That's like electricity asking, you know, some master. If electricity has all of the power, then why don't we recognize it like we recognize those lamps over there lighting up? Right? It's the same question. If electricity has its own power, why don't we see that power like we see those lights lighting up? And the answer is Those lights light up because of electricity. As the self shines fully of its own accord, why is it not generally recognized, like the other objects of the world, by all persons? Answer. Wherever particular objects are known, it is the self which has known itself in the form of those objects. Or we could say the electricity knows itself in the light of the lamp. Wherever particular objects are known, it is the self which has known itself in the form of those objects. For what is known as knowledge or awareness is only the potency of the self. Or in the electricity example, what is known as the light of the lamp is only the power of electricity. The self is the only sentient object. There is nothing apart from the self. The electricity is the only power. There's no other power that lights these lamps. If there are such objects, they are all insentient and therefore cannot either know themselves or mutually know one another. The lamps are powerless. They have no life or light of their own. It is because the self does not know its true nature in this manner that it seems to be immersed in the struggling, it seems to be immersed and struggling in the ocean of birth in the form of the individual soul. So this confusion that the self has regarding its nature, believing itself to be an individual soul with a body that temporarily has life, causes it to miss the fact that it is life. And any appearance that appears to be alive, it is the life that makes that appearance dance. Question number 7. Although the Lord is all pervasive, it appears from passages like adorning him through his grace that he can be known only through his grace. How then can the individual soul by its own efforts attain self-realization in the absence of the Lord's grace? And many, many masters recommend self-effort as the means to achieving awakening. And this person is saying, but it's not self-effort, it's grace. You know, I could effort all day, all week, all year, my whole life, and without grace I will never awaken. That's what this person's argument is. And so here's Ramana Maharshi's answer. As the Lord denotes the self, and as grace means the Lord's presence or revelation, there is no time when the Lord remains unknown. If the light of the sun is invisible to the owl, it is only the fault of that bird and not of the sun. Similarly, can the unawareness by ignorant persons of the self, which is always of the nature of awareness, be other than their own fault? How can it be the fault of the self? It is because grace is the very nature of the Lord that he is well known as the blessed grace. Therefore, the Lord, whose nature is grace, does not have to bestow his grace, nor is there any particular time for bestowing his grace. And so if we translate this, what Ramana Maharshi is saying is that awareness is ever present. Awareness does not have to bestow itself upon you so that you can become aware of it. You're the one who has your eyes closed. You're the one who's focusing outward. You're the one who's looking away. It is there, ever present. It doesn't need to do anything. You're the one that needs to reverse your habits. You need to reverse your habits of focusing out and learn to focus on awareness, focus in. That's a pretty simple answer. I don't know that I have any more to say about that. That's a pretty simple answer. You know, it's always here. It's always present. It's always now. You're the one that's looking away. Look at it. Stay with looking at it. Abide with looking at it, and you will come to know it. Continue to ignore it, and you won't, but it's still there. So question number 8, since that was so simple. What part of the body is the abode of the self? Ramana Maharshi answers, the heart on the right side of the chest is generally indicated. This is because we usually point to the right side of the chest when we refer to ourselves. Some say that the thousand-petaled lotus is the abode of the self. But if that were true, the head should not fall forward when we go to sleep or faint. Now, I'll tell you what I get out of this answer. Ramana Maharshi's not giving an answer. If you really look carefully at Ramana Maharshi, and the person asks, what part of the body is the abode of the self? Well, the truth is, no part of the body is the abode of the self. You know, the self is within, I mean, the body is within the self. The self is not within the body. You see, that's still that confusion that I am the body and I have life. But it looks like Ramana Maharshi isn't seeing this as I'll say, worth the effort to address. Maybe he sees that the one before him asking these questions is not truly ready for the answer. And so the answer that he gives is one that's just generally accepted within the Hindu religion. And if you listen carefully to the words, that's what he's saying. This is what people think. he's not telling what is. He's just saying this is what people think. He says, the heart on the right side of the chest is generally indicated. Right? This is because we usually point to the right side of the chest when we refer to ourselves. So this must be a Hindu thing, because here in America we don't, we point to the center of the chest. But in India they must point to the right side of the chest. And he's saying, since we tend to point at the right side of the chest, people say that's where the self is. He's just repeating back what culture says. He's not actually giving an answer. Some say, you know, so some people say it's the right side of the chest. Some say that the thousand-petaled lotus is the abode of the self. Right? But if that were true, the head would not fall forward when we go to sleep or faint. So, you know, that's not true. But he didn't really give an answer. And so a wise question might be, why didn't he give an answer? And it's because the question was all wrong. You know, what part of the body is the abode of the self? The question is all wrong. And I will tell you that if you're someone who is learning to write with inner wisdom, to ask questions of inner wisdom, and then to receive an answer and to write it out, the question is critical. If you've seen the movie The Peaceful Warrior, you remember that Socrates told Dan Millman, you have to learn to ask better questions. When asking a question of inner wisdom, if the question is not right, the answer will not be right. And in fact, if the question is really wrong, what could be answering is the ego. In fact, what will be answering is the ego. So, for example, if you have fears about money, and you ask the question, how can I get more money? Inner spiritual wisdom isn't going to say a thing. Inner spiritual wisdom will be completely silent, but the ego may have a thing or two to say. However, if you have fears about money and you say, I am really terrified right now because I don't have any money. I'm worried about my safety. What will you share with me? Being open to anything that inner wisdom will share. Well, inner wisdom will come back and teach you things like how to rest, accept, and trust. How to use this opportunity for the healing of your mind. Same situation, two different questions. Two different types of response. In fact, responses from two different sources. One from the ego when I ask, how can I get more money? And one from genuine inner spiritual wisdom when I say, I'm afraid, what will you share with me? The question is critical. Only good questions receive good answers. You know, and I apologize for using the word good, but I don't know how else to say this. I could say only worthy questions receive worthy answers, but that's just poorly stated. But hopefully you get my point. And I don't feel like going on to the next one. The next one's kind of long, and we only have 3 minutes left. So what I'm going to do is just mark this as where we'll begin next week. And I can play a Christmas song, right? Because now I have 3 minutes. So I'm going to YouTube. And I'm going to the... Of course, my computer is so slow, it may take my 3 minutes just to get there. Awakening Together Christmas List. Here we go. And let's see, I played this song, the first song the other day. So let me move down to another fun song. I'm just going to kind of spin the dial. Okay, I don't even know what this song is, so let's listen to it. It's Christopher Cross, The Best Christmas. Let's see what Christopher Cross thinks the best Christmas is.
Beneath the Christmas tree that stood so very tall. Papa sang the Christmas songs, my mama danced and smiled. That was my best Christmas when I was just a child. We built the snowman in the park and dressed him up so fine. We were young. Life was fun, the world was yours and mine. Beneath the mistletoe we kissed, I whispered, I love you. That was my best Christmas, when you said you loved me too. So let's sing a Merry Christmas, hang our Christmas star. Up to a mountain snow the windows are locked in ice. Miles from home, no telephone, the earth lay frozen white. The radio played Christmas songs, the ash burned warm and true. That was my best Christmas, snowed in all day with you. The city wore its Christmas clothes, and carols filled the air. Girls and boys and shiny toys, and shoppers filled the square.
I'm gonna stop that. It's kind of a sweet song. It sounds like he's listing every Christmas he can remember and saying, that was my best Christmas. It's kind of like I say with NTI. That's my favorite part of NTI. But I say that about all of them. So the specialness that isn't special. All right, everyone, I'm releasing the mic. Thank you very much. Bye.